Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Discovery Debrief, a podcast that dives headfirst into the proverbial deep end of the latest trek into the final frontier, Star Trek Discovery. I'm co-host Chris Clow, and on this episode, we're doing something a little different overall compared with other episodes we've done before. This episode primarily consists of an interview with a more prominent member of the Trek extended family than we've had on the show before, and features myself and co-hosts Rachel Clow and Cicero Holmes asking questions of our guest and generally just celebrating some of the greatness that makes Star Trek what it is. Unfortunately, Zaki Hassan couldn't join us for this episode due to his becoming lost in interphasic space, but don't worry. Cicero agreed to jump to the Mirror Universe 100 years in the past and should be picking him up to get him back on our command deck very soon. This episode should be of particular interest to those of you who pay attention to the Star Trek Expanded Universe, as well as those curious about how Discovery potentially allows for greater and deeper engagement with established Star Trek canon. So, without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with the author of Star Trek Discovery Drastic Measures, Mr. Dayton Ward. Well, if you listen to our recent episode discussing the newest Discovery tie-in novel, then we got a treat for you. We're about to talk to the man whose brain is responsible for that story, since he agreed to join us for a Trek conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome author extraordinaire, Mr. Dayton Ward. Dayton?
Hello. How y'all doing?
Hey, doing just fine. Doing thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I mean, we basically are a show that came together because of Discovery. So I didn't even realize until the show had started that there were tie-in novels that were coming out. And yours, as soon as I heard about it, was immediately intriguing to me just because of Captain Georgiou. And I, shame on me, I didn't realize that you have actually been involved with writing Star Trek stories for a number of years now. But we actually just did an episode that unpacked Drastic Measures. And I think one of the things that struck us the most about it was that you had such a meticulous attention to detail in terms of aspects of the larger canon that you very much adhere to. But before we jump into that, what's your secret origin, so to speak? How, where, and when did you discover your passion for Star Trek? And what led you to the position of being able to tell stories in that universe?
Well, I am older. I grew up, I was in elementary school, you know, single digit kid in the 70s. So I was watching reruns of the original show after school. And I watched the animated show when it was first run. And I played with the toys, and I built the models, and I read the comics, and we all shot our eyes out with those little tracer guns with the little plastic discs.
Nice.
Played Star Trek on the playground and all that kind of stuff. And so I've been reading the comics and the books and whatever else that, you know, you find at your bookstore or your library pretty much from the point I could read. I'm pretty sure that the first book I ever checked out of a library was one of those episode adaptation collections from James Blish.
Oh, yeah.
I can't prove that, but it seems like that would be something I would do because I'm a bit of a nerd in that regard. As far as writing Star Trek, I got started way back. Actually, it's 20 years ago. I submitted a short story to the very first Star Trek Strange New Worlds writing contest that Pocketbooks was sponsoring. This would have been back in the summer of 97. And so my story was one of the ones that they picked for that first anthology. And I got paid and we all got a contract and, you know, you got to see your name in print and then lights and all that kind of stuff. And I did it again for the second and third year of the contest, at which point I rendered myself ineligible to enter that contest again, because now I'm using the air quotes, a professional writer. So when they bought my third story, the editor at the time at Pocket, John Ordover, he called me and, you know, hey, I'm buying your story. You're no longer allowed to enter my contest. How would you like to write a Star Trek novel for me? And so that's basically how I got started. And I've been pretty much doing it ever since.
Wow. That's so you basically did go from super fan to being able to play with the toys in the toy box on an official level then.
Pretty much. That's how it's a weird way to get there. But yeah, that's pretty much how it happened.
Oh, that's great. So, and clearly you've been a fan of the franchise for a really long time since you were a little kid. One of the things that I just wanted to ask you from the perspective of a fan, and you know, nowadays we're seeing this weird sort of tribal toxicity. We're seeing it in politics, of course. We're seeing it all over the place. But it's also coming into fandom where you have these gatekeepers who are kind of trying to say that Discovery isn't necessarily a legitimate entry in the canon. We all love the show, so we don't believe that at all. But how do you see those kinds of reactions, and how does it compare to when the very first Star Trek spinoffs first started coming on the air, from your estimation?
It's exactly the same. It really is. Yeah. I mean, I remember when they first announced Next Generation. It was at the first time I heard about Next Generation was at a creation convention in Anaheim, California, in the summer of 1986. And that was when they were all on stage. Everybody, you know, the original cast was still alive. Roddenberry was still alive. Star Trek IV was coming soon to a theater near you. And they unveiled this notion that they were going to do a spinoff with a new crew set 100 years after the original show. Most fans were excited by the idea that we were getting new Star Trek. And of course, there was that segment of fandom who lost their minds. And it wasn't going to work. You can't duplicate this. You can't capture lightning in a bottle twice. Blah, 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 blah. And over, I was a member of the Star Trek fan club, the one that Dan Madsen was the president of back in the day. And you had a bi-monthly fan club magazine that he put out. And he got exclusive interviews with like Roddenberry and other people involved with the movies at the time. And as they were ramping up production for Next Generation, he got some of the first photos that you ever saw. And, you know, the general reader feedback was about 50-50. Some people were excited and other people were just, this is never going to work, yada, yada, yada. And it's been that way every time there's been a new spinoff. I mean, I watched it for every spinoff. And then when they rebooted it for the new films and then when Discovery was announced, it's the same reaction. It's just we have, with each generation, we have more tools at our disposal to broadcast our displeasure. More in real time. So I just kind of, I roll my eyes a lot and I laugh a lot and then I go back to work.
So the intensity doesn't seem any larger or smaller to you this time around?
I think it's more visible because we as individuals are able to, we have a voice on the internet through social media. Right. So it just seems magnified, but I honestly think it's not any different in terms of percentage of fandom.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's going to be people who love everything. There's going to be people who can never be happy. And there's going to be that middle ground, which is the majority of people who just like, if it's good, I'll watch it. If it's not good, I'll watch something else. You know?
Sure.
Right. So Dayton, there seems to be no ambiguity about the fact that you are a lover of Star Trek. But you know, we, if, you know, anyone has done any research about you, they also know that you have, some hardcore sci-fi chops overall. What is it about Star Trek that keeps you coming back? What is it about Star Trek that keeps you engaged and in love with the universe for over 40 years?
I think it's just the basic message, you know, it's we are better than we were and we can be better than we are, and how we get there, that's where all the cool stories are told.
Right.
That's pretty much been Star Trek from the jump, you know.
It's definitely one of the things that I find most personally compelling and necessarily hopeful when I'm having a bad day. Star Trek is always there.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how you keep everything straight, especially if you write in other universes as well. How do you keep all the continuity and all the details? Do you just have it like burned into your brain from so many years of being a fan, or do you have like a system, or what do you do?
Well, it's a good question. I've never tried to really quantify it. It's to varying degrees. Like, you know, I'm a huge original series fan, so I know a lot of minuscule trivia bits from that show that would frighten people. I could win a trivia pursuit contest. But, and then of course that knowledge varies depending on the series. You know, it's like I'm not as embedded with Voyager, for example, or Enterprise, because I just haven't had a lifetime of being immersed in it, or being surrounded by it, or just enjoying it. I'll get there. I mean, Next Gen's a pretty close second. You know, I get there. I mean, but as far as keeping track of it all, I don't even try. I know where to look. If I don't know the answer to the question, I at least know where to look for it. You know, so before the internet, I have a whole bookcase full of reference material. And now I've got all of that plus the internet. So if I can't find it, it cannot be found.
Well, and that kind of piggybacks on something that I wanted to ask you about in relation to the specific production of this newest book, because from what I understand anyway, to a certain degree, since you're collaborating, at least in some respect, with one of the show's writers, if you have a window into the show's writer's room, then you're able to sort of refer to things that we may not be aware of, or even that you may not fully be aware of, that's coming down through the show. How does that work exactly?
Well, I mean, this book was different from all the other Star Trek stories I've written, because not only – first of all, it's the first time I've written a book where the show it's based on is in active production. Everything else that I've done was, you know, after the series had wrapped. To, you know, in some cases, we're talking decades. I wrote my first Next Gen book in 2003. So that's, you know, a decade after the show went off the air.
Oh, wow.
But for this, not only is the show in production, but at the time I was figuring out what my story was going to be about, they were still developing the show. They hadn't even gotten all the wickets navigated yet. They were still figuring it out. There were a lot of conversations. There was a lot of email. There was a lot of phone calls. Kirsten Beyer, who, as you alluded to, is in the writer's room. She's my window into the writer's room. She and I have been friends for years. She's also a Star Trek novelist in her own right. In fact, she called me for the first time. I want to say it was right before Christmas 2015 to tell me that she'd been hired to work on the show. And that was before any official announcement had been made. And then over the next 5 or 6 months, I would get these infrequent phone calls where she would call me and ask me some aspect of Star Trek trivia. And at the time, I mean, I knew she was developing the show or helping to develop the show, but I had no idea what they were doing. And then as those conversations evolved, then I got a sense of where they were going to set it and what was going to be the story points and some of the character ideas they were coming up with. And then later in 2016, she asked me if I was interested in writing one of the Discovery novels that they were planning for. So I knew in the fall of 2016 that I was going to write this book. They didn't even announce it until a year later. So and for that entire period, I was under a non-disclosure agreement where I could not discuss anything about the show or my involvement in the show. And so there was speculation because they had announced Dave Mack is the writer of the first book at Mission New York, that convention they held in the fall of 2016 to celebrate the 50th anniversary. So for a year, I had to walk around, you know, nobody knows what I'm working on. And I couldn't even hint at the idea that I was even involved in any way with the show. But all the while, I'm talking to Kirsten. She's picking my brain and I'm developing my storyline for the novel. And then, so as far as that relationship, Kirsten is my main conduit. I mean, through her, I've been able to get, you know, questions answered by other members of the writing staff or other members of the production crew. But she is the person that they put in charge of dealing with us funny writer people, us book writers and comic people. They, you know, like, you speak their language, go talk to them. Don't let it that way. We don't have to. So she's been our liaison, so to speak, gatekeeper, nanny, whatever you want to call her.
That's awesome. So
the this book was awesome, not only because it gives us an opportunity to witness Prime Lorca as a main character in a very real way, but we also get to talk about one of the most infamous moments in Starfleet history, the massacre of Tarsus IV. Or the cleansing, or, you know, whatever you guys want to, you know, what people want to call it. But, how much of that portion of the story was presented to you, and how much input and, direction did you have in, or control did you have in, determining the outcome of the story and the direction of the story?
I was given a very wide latitude in terms of how I was going to flesh out the backstory of Tarsus IV. And as far as the characters of Giorgio and Lorca, I was given some latitude as far as fleshing out their backstory with respect to this incident, you know, and a few other details that get sprinkled in along the way. Originally, Kirsten had asked me if I wanted to write a Lorca-centric story. And that was my initial direction. We had batted around some ideas. And in fact, at one point, the storyline we were considering was I was going to write what happened to him when he was the captain of the other ship prior to Discovery, the Baran.
Oh, okay.
So I was going to flesh out that that bit of lore. Because they, at the time, had not decided whether they were going to portray this on screen or not. They were. That was how early in the process we're talking about here. I mean, I was working on my outline before they even shot the first scene. As I was starting to, because one of the things that I was given access to during all of this was they gave us access to scripts and production art, and we knew who the cast, who was being cast in the different roles before they were made available to the public. And I got to see, as the show began production, they started shooting, they would send us set photography. So not video, but actual, you know, while the scenes were being filmed, somebody was on stage making, you know, shooting photography. So I got to see the costumes and the sets and the makeups and all that kind of cool stuff. And a lot of green screen. Man, there was a lot of green screen on that show. but it helped. And then, but anyway, as I was reading the first few scripts, I really started to take a liking to Georgiou's character. Even though we know what happens to her very early on in the show, I was still digging her character. And, you know, so I pushed back a little bit gently and asked Kirsten, and, you know, I'd really like to write something that involves Georgiou in some manner. And it was either her or I don't remember now, it was either her or my editor at Pocketbooks, Margaret Clark, who said, well, why don't we have a story with both of them? So once that was thrown out there, then I had to go back to the drawing board and figure out a new story that would involve both of these characters. And so we knew all along they were going to be prequels set before the events of the show. We just didn't, there had been no real direction at that point on how far back or with respect to what. And one of the things that Dave Mack and I both wanted to do was try to tie Discovery into the larger Trek mythology in some manner. And so you know how Dave did it with his book, where he partners up the Shenzhou with the Enterprise. And so his adventures takes place like about a year before the show. And if I set mine even farther back in the past, I probably won't get harassed a whole lot while they change up things as they're making the show. So I started looking around for points of interest in the Trek timeline, and Tarsis IV was one of the events. And I think it was Margaret who actually lobbied for that one. She helped me lobby with that. Nice. Kirsten, and Kirsten was.
So Tarsis IV was your idea, essentially.
Well, it was a mix of, hey, here's one of the things that happens during this time frame, Tarsis IV. So we put a pin in it, right. And then we looked around for some other things, and we came up with some other ideas. But Tarsis IV, we kept coming back to it. It's like, this would be a fun one, because it's never really, it's been fleshed out a couple times in the books, but they have different takes on it, or it's always from Kirk's perspective, or it's always from, you know, it's like that. So this would have been a fun way to put a new twist on it. So once we pitched that idea, Kirsten and the people at the writers, the folks on the staff, were like, yeah, sure, go for it. Go with God.
So at what point did you know that the Lorca you were depicting in your book was not quite the same Lorca we were going to see on the show? And how did you make any changes to accommodate for that?
I knew before I started writing the manuscript that it was that you all were going to be seeing Mirror Lorca. What had not been determined at that point, because they hadn't written that far ahead yet, was how, when, why that was going to be revealed, and what happened to real Lorca. In other words, they hadn't yet decided how they were going to tackle those questions. So, but of course, you know, the writing staff on the show has their ideas about what Prime Lorca is like. So that helped me as far as developing that character. But yeah, because it was kind of weird. I'm like, I'm writing a character that we're seeing on TV, but it's not really that same person. I don't think I've had to do that before. But so I kind of, it's like walking a line between a character you know and developing an original character that's brand new to the reader. It's sort of like writing original fiction almost, or writing a spin-off novel, where like we do with some of the other titles where we have our own crews and ships that we play with sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I mean, it seems like a weird kind of backtracking that you would have to do, because there's not necessarily a roadmap of guidance with how you can extrapolate backward from a mirror version of a character to the prime version, because this is the first time that, at least to my knowledge anyway, it's the first time we've seen a mirror universe character without having seen the prime version at all.
And so what was, and of course that was a topic of much discussion, as you might imagine, because I'm like, when are y'all going to show us the real Lorca? Well, we don't know yet. Right. And of course my big question was, when did the switch happen? You know, when did that swap out occur? And that far back in the development process, they hadn't yet decided on that. And, but I knew it wasn't 10 years before the show, so I was safe. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, that begat the whole the what I call the post credit scene at the end of the book.
Yeah,
which was not my idea, actually. That was
really
that was an idea that was floated by Kirsten. She said she wanted to have this scene, and she wanted it to be the last scene in the book. And I said, I basically counter suggested, why don't we make it a post credit scene, like after the bibliography and after the acknowledgments and after the about the author and whatever ads you want to stick in the back of the book, just tag it and don't even tell anybody. Just leave it there. And then let's see how long it takes people to find it.
That's incredible. So we listened to the audiobook version and they put it at the very end of the audiobook version. Literally the last thing you hear is, Audible hopes you enjoyed this program. And so I had to, my wife actually skipped over it. I had to tell you.
I didn't. He started asking me questions about it, and I'm like, "What are you talking about?"
One of the things that I've been doing with the last few books is, you know, they've restarted the audio program for Star Trek novels, and so one of the additional duties I get is I work with the audio folks to create a pronunciation guide to make sure that all the alien names and all the tech and all the weird planet names and races and all that, all those things are pronounced correctly by the reader of the audiobook. So I get a guide and they have their list, and then I help with the phonetic pronunciation of it. And they asked me point blank, do you want to have this scene before the, you know, the audible credits or the, you know, the audio work credits, or do you want to have it? I'm like, I want it at the very end. I want that last, I want people to be looking and wonder why there's an extra track at the end of this audiobook when they said they're done. That was, and she called me twice to verify that. I'm like, no, really, it's gotta be the very last thing. So I'm glad it worked out that way.
No, it's pretty phenomenal. And that was actually one of the things that has been burning in my brain ever since you said that you'd come on with this is, and I was just thinking like, okay, how do I broach this gently? I don't know how much he's going to be able to talk about this. And then you just say that it was an idea of the show's writer, because I mean, Cicero, when we had our weekly episode discussion, Cicero is convinced that we're never going to see Prime Lorca.
Yes.
And I absolutely do not want that to be the case. But this kind of leads into another question that I had for you, because one of the things that I have had to illustrate to a couple of our listeners who have read a significant amount of Star Wars expanded universe material, but not that much Star Trek expanded universe material, is that the canonicity in terms of Star Trek material is very much in flux. Like, they could choose to take some, but it's not technically canon. But with the involvement of the writer's room, as you understand it, and obviously you can't make a declaration, of course, but as you understand it, how solidly canonical are these stories that we've seen from you and from David Mack?
It's from what I can see, it's a case of it's official, it's canon, it happened until we say it didn't. You know, it's sort of in other words, if they come up with a better idea for Lorca's backstory than what was given in one of these books, then that's what they're going to go with, because they're the show and we are the ancillary material. And that's that's the nature of tie-in work. You knew that. I mean, I knew the job was dangerous when I took it. If Giorgio or somebody, if we ever, you know, or if Lorca comes back and he talks about that time on Tarsus IV, you will hear me scream in triumph from my house in Kansas City. Will that happen? I have no idea. I honestly don't know what their plans are with respect to Prime Lorca. And even if I knew them, I couldn't tell you.
He's not coming back.
No idea.
Those are the plans. Those are the plans. He's not coming back. What I suggested to Chris as we were talking about in our discussion of the book, as we were talking about that post credit scene, was the fact that the reason that was there was so that someone that is, you know, great at writing, such as yourself, can write some stories about the further adventures of Prime Lorca in the Mirror Universe.
It's possible. I mean, I don't know what their plans are for Discovery novels beyond the one that's coming out here in about a week or so. There's a third Discovery novel coming out in June. It's a Saru-based tale written by James Swallow. I don't know what the next novels for Discovery will be, or whether they'll let us do that. Like, will they let us play with Prime Lorca? I would love it. If they asked me to do that, I would totally jump at the opportunity. Just because I had so much fun writing this one. But no, I have no idea.
Sure.
No idea. I'll see. Yeah, I'll wait for the phone. I'm waiting for the phone to ring.
Well, it's got to be kind of at least part of the fun. As a fan, when you were able to actually absorb the episodes of the show, what do you make of it? How does it compare with other Star Trek to you?
Well, I mean, obviously it's different in terms of its approach. You know, it's serialized. It's very heavily serialized, even more so than the most serialized portions of DS9. It's a little darker. But you know, bear in mind that this was a story that they wanted to tell, a particular story with these beats in it that they wanted to tell. And my understanding for next year is that they're going to change up the formula a little bit. So it's not going to be a war based tale like we had this year. I like it. It's not your dad's Star Trek, but then again, my dad hated Star Trek. So that doesn't really matter, but it's not the same Star Trek I grew up with, but that's okay. I mean, I don't want to keep watching the same thing over and over again. I mean, as far as it being produced, I mean, I've got those DVD, or I've got those Blu-rays. I can watch them anytime I want. I want something different. I want to change up the formula. Yeah. I want them to explore different types of storytelling. I want them to be a little more complex, more sophisticated. Which is one of the reasons why we play around with the way we do with the books. It's like, you know, I don't know if you've read any of the spinoff series that we have, like Star Trek Vanguard, which is the TOS. It takes place in the TOS time frame, but there's a more sophisticated, a little bit grittier storytelling style in play there. Some people have likened it to, you know, the original Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry pitched it as Wagon Train in space, or, you know, Wagon Train to the Stars. Well, Vanguard is Deadwood in space. That's how we describe it. So, but yet at the heart of it, it's still Star Trek. I mean, we still strive to make those Star Trek stories. And I think that at the heart of Discovery, there's a Star Trek story. It took a while, you know, it takes its own time to get there. It does it in a way we're not used to seeing. So that rubs people the wrong way. But, you know, at the end of it all, there's a Star Trek story in the core there.
As a fan, were there any aspects of the show that you maybe would have done differently or more efficiently?
Hard to say. Again, because this was a deliberate, you know, the way they laid the story out was a deliberate choice on their part. Would I have done something different if they'd given me the keys and said, go make a Star Trek series? Sure, I would have come up with something different. Not necessarily better. Just I have my own fantasies about what I would do if I would write a Star Trek series.
So you're always thinking about it. Then you're ready for the next one as soon as the call comes in.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's always a kernel of an idea somewhere, or I read an article in the newspaper or online somewhere, and I go, I can twist that into a story idea, and then I put it in my file somewhere, which keeps getting fatter by the year.
I have
more story springboard ideas than I'll probably ever get to, but
oh, that's probably better than not enough, I would think. But no, that's a good thing to have. How long did it take you specifically in the case of Drastic Measures from manuscript to actually final edits and turning everything in?
I wrote my first draft manuscript in the early part of 2017. So probably that first 4 or 5 months of the year. 4 months or so, I turned in a manuscript sometime in April, I think. And then I did not get it back until June, July, somewhere in that neighborhood. Yeah, it was June, because I had to immediately tell my editor, I can't do anything with this for a month because I'm finishing up another project. So I sat on it it sat in my queue for like a month. So I didn't actually get back to my revisions until July. And there were a lot of revisions, mostly because of things that had been developed behind the scenes on the show, you know, during the time I was writing and the time that I turned it in. They had made some decisions about directions for certain characters that they wanted me to make sure that I was aware of. And then there were just other things that the writers wanted me to do differently, or they wanted me to add an aspect. Like, for example, you've read the book. Everybody's read the book, right?
Yeah.
So there's a device that I use in the book where there are people who survived the incident are interviewed.
Yes.
Right. Yes.
The 4,000.
Right. The 4,000 book. And originally, my idea for that was that you would not meet the interviewer. It would be a faceless, voiceless interviewer, kind of like the way Max Brooks did when he wrote World War Z. Mm-hmm. You know, the emphasis was on the people who survived the zombie war, not the person conducting the interview. He was not a character. So I did my approach that way, and Kirsten came back and said she wanted the interviewer to be a character. And we molded over and decided that the girl that Giorgio meets is going to grow up and be the author of this book. So that was one change I had to make. So I had to write all the stuff at the end of the book to support that, and then go back and rewrite some of the interview sequences, knowing now that there, you know, this interviewer was going to be introduced at a later point. So things like that. And then, of course, the post-credit scene came later. And what you read is about 50% of what I wrote. I wrote a much longer, more detailed post-credit scene that would offer more clues as to where he was and who had him captured and all that kind of thing. And they cut out a lot of that stuff because they didn't want to give it all away.
Okay. All right. So,
So that adds some more credence. Please, Dayton, don't give him any more fodder to this. So this Lorca is still alive, you know, hashtag bring back Lorca. Yeah. Hey, there's no need for this.
Well, I mean, it's really cool to hear, though, that, you know, that level of involvement is there with, because I don't often hear about expanded universe material getting that kind of access outside of something like Star Wars, which is a machine that's always turning. But that's got to be a pretty cool thing to be privy to, especially as a Star Trek fan. I can't imagine what it would be like to actually kind of steer the ship to a degree. Now, one of the things that I did want to ask you, since you kind of brought up the end scene where you do meet the author of the 4000, when she mentions that she tried to contact Lorca and was told that he politely declined. In your mind, or at least as the way you understand it, did Mirror Lorca get that invitation and didn't know what the hell to make of it, so declined? Or was it because Prime Lorca just didn't want to revisit the memories of Tarsus IV?
In my brain, it was Mirror Lorca punting.
Okay. All right. Yeah. We were curious about that.
I guess there's room for interpretation either way. When I wrote that, the way it was written, it was with the full knowledge that, you know, you all were going to meet Mirror Lorca. In fact, we even discussed how to, that was one of the things that Kirsten and I discussed, was how to broach the subject of why she doesn't talk to Lorca. And I'm like, well, let's just leave it and let everybody draw their own conclusion.
Apparently some kind of transposition has taken place.
There you go. Nicely done. Nicely done.
Thank you.
One of the great successes of the book in my eye was and I think a great success of any piece of narrative work is getting the antagonist and showing the antagonist to the consumer as someone that is worthy of empathy. And I think that, you know, as hateful as the butcher of Tarsus IV was, I thought that you did a brilliant job of making the processes and the motivations of Adrian Kodos plainly available for the reader and for the listener. So I just want to say that, you know, kudos and bravo for doing that. What was going through your head to try and figure out, to get yourself in the mind of Adrian Kodos to really kind of present him in a way that made him sound not necessarily reasonable, but at least rational with his thought process?
Well, I mean, you know, setting aside the idea that there's really no good look here for Kodos. I mean, there's just no way to spin this so that it's a good look. Right.
Right.
But, you know, I think we can agree that the best villains are always the ones that you can, if not agree with, you can at least understand their motivation. And of course, they always think they're doing the right thing for the right reason. No matter how screwed up it is, they come across as being totally sold on the idea that this is the way to go. So not twirling the mustache, not doing evil for evil's sake. There is a reason, a justification, an explanation that these people are prepared to live with, you know, in terms of why they do what they do. That to me is more interesting. And what I found when I started doing the research for the book, you know, obviously I rewatched the episode again and I've already seen it 100 times, but you know, there's very little information about Kodos beyond what we see in that episode. There's almost nothing. Everything that comes is from other material. It's either another book or that Kirk autobiography book or some other novel has touched on it in some degree. But beyond what's in the episode itself, there's literally nothing of use in terms of research. And of course, even the details that they offer in the episode are very scant. We don't know how the plague started. We don't know why it started. We don't know why it got out of control so fast. We don't understand how he got away. I mean, and of course, it was written back in the 60s before we had DNA testing. You know, it's like, oh, the body was burned beyond recognition. Well, okay, I've seen every episode of CSI, so I know how this works. But I mean, we had to have that conversation, though. I mean, I had to talk it out with my editor about how do I convince the 23rd century forensics team that this body is Kodos, you know, at the end of the story. It's like, how do we, everybody that reads this book has seen every episode of CSI or Criminal Intent or Law and Order, you know, they know how this works. I have to come up with a believable answer.
Well, even the photos too, right? The photos I thought was a pretty genius stroke on your part, because and especially even in today's day and age, right, with the prevalence of social media, how in the 23rd century, how can someone get rid of all of the pictures of them that are out there?
It has to be a deliberate effort is where we arrived at. It's like it has to be a calculated, deliberate effort on his part to conceal his true identity. And it had to – so basically that was all part of his motivation. So then you realize he's really thought this out. But is he really psychotic or is he just really committed? And so it was, you know, these were interesting conversations to have, because once you pull on the threads of that episode, it's kind of weak, particularly by modern standards. Like, how am I supposed to get away with this? So, yeah, there was a lot of conversation about how to convincingly carry this off. And of course, you know, you're hampered a little bit by the fact that we all know he gets away and he survives for another 20 years before he's found out again. So I know how the journey ends. So now it's about the trip itself. It's kind of like writing a World War II story or, you know, a story set on the Titanic. We all know how that story ends. So now you have to make it interesting for the people that are along for the ride. Well, yeah, then we just all want to get on the floating door. that was, you know, it was an interesting bit. And of course, you know, you want to tie it into as we said, we wanted to tie it into the larger mythology and respect what's there. And in my view, I was – it's not so much legitimize Discovery. I don't think it needed to be legitimized, but it's fun to tie it into the larger tapestry in some way. It's always fun to tap into it. That's to me part of the fun of writing Star Trek stories, is to try to find some way to stitch it into the quilt, you know, so to speak.
So did you – I read the autobiography of James Kirk, and I was wondering if you sort of actively tried to make your story different from the Tarsis IV stories that had been sort of fleshed out before, or did you like incorporate any ideas? Or
I took some broad strokes from the autobiography, mostly because the only piece that's really there, it's told from young Jim Kirk's point of view. And so he doesn't have the big picture. He at least not at that point in time, he wouldn't have the big picture. So I took, in the broad strokes, like how the plague started, I kind of put a twist on it so that we could have the dilemma of the immigration refugee angle, which of course is not topical at all. Yeah. So once we had that in place, I'm like, okay, I can not so much have fun with it, but there's some play to have here with, you know, hey, we can touch on current events the way Star Trek does well when it's firing on all cylinders. And, you know, as far as I looked at William Shatner and the Reef Stevens wrote a book where he has a encounter. You know, they flesh out the Tarsis IV backstory in a different way. That's completely on its own. I didn't go up there with that one because that was like more conspiracy theory related. But I did remember I did use the broad strokes of what was in the autobiography book, at least as a starting point. And then I may have put a couple twists on it.
Yeah, sure. It seems, I mean, I gotta, at least from my perspective, I would think that that would be at least a little bit of a benefit, is having, like you said before, all those kinds of reference materials, even if there's some things that kind of similarly dabble into directions that you're going to, it still also provides something of a roadmap for how your own ideas could be different, right?
Well, I mean, my instructions were that I did not need to be constrained by anything that had been written before.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they told me, you have a blank slate, do what you need to do for this story to work. But that said, I'm still a fan and I'm still a nerd. So if I don't have to outright contradict something, I will avoid doing so. If I can find a sly way to make a reference to an older story or an older book, I will do that. In fact, I did it in this book with the end where Robert April and the Enterprise shows up.
Yeah.
There are a couple of nods there. One is the fact that, you know, they were delayed before they got to Tarsus IV. That's a nod to a short story that Greg Cox wrote a number of years ago in an anthology called Enterprise Logs, where he specifically is nice. On his way to Tarsus IV and they get waylaid by Klingons. But April's portrayal, where he comes off as a sort of eccentric dude where he wears a cardigan sweater over his Starfleet uniform, that is a nod to Diane Carey, who wrote a couple of books back in the 80s called Final Frontier and Best Destiny, which that is her representation of Robert April, which those of us who've written April stories since have always kind of done that. We've always given that nod to her portrayal of the character.
That's interesting. Yeah, because we had watched the Counterclock incident ahead of time before reading the book, because I think one of us had heard ahead of time that April had showed up in it and didn't see a significant amount of continuity. So I was wondering if there was something else that your depiction was derived from. So that totally answers that question. That's really cool.
Yeah, we're all nerds. The people who write the Star Trek books, we're all fans to one, and we're all nerds about it to one degree or another, sometimes alarmingly so. I mean, they probably should tag us.
No, that's perfect. That's exactly who you want writing Star Trek books, at least in my estimation. Well, you know, one of the things that I find fascinating about your background is the fact that you have a history of service in the United States Marine Corps. And in the context of Star Trek, the thing that immediately comes to my mind is what shapes your perspective on the Federation and Starfleet? Because, I mean, I'm sure, as you well know, one of the more well-known stories in terms of the behind the scenes of Star Trek is the fact that Nicholas Meyer and Gene Roddenberry had a bit of a conflict about how hard they depict Starfleet as a military organization. And of course, the franchise would go on to delve into war in DS9 and in Discovery itself. So when it comes to you and your own ability to tell stories in the Star Trek universe, how would you say your time in the military affected your conception of Starfleet or the characters, if at all?
I think it plays a role. I mean, in the beginning, I think it was limited more to, okay, I understand how command hierarchies work and how military protocol works and customs and courtesies and courts martial and other things like that. But what I tell people, you know, because there's always that argument, is Starfleet a military organization? I'm like, well, you know, show me the group that fights the war and I'll stop having this conversation. They are a military organization. But what I try to stress is, they're evolved from what we currently understand as a military organization, the same way that the modern military does not represent the military of the 18th century. You know, the mission of the military will evolve, and just as it has continued to evolve since its inception, it will expand its duties. It'll retract in others. It'll be given different responsibilities as we expand outward. I mean, assuming this all comes to pass. So no, it's a military organization, but they just put an emphasis and a priority on different things than we currently do, or, you know, a current day military would do. And they go out there with a different mindset. Their first mindset is not offensive. They are an exploratory body, but they are obviously a military structure, and they have that training and they have that background when the balloon goes up and you have to go to war. But it's just a different mentality. It's not an apples to apples comparison. It's not a fair thing to just say it is or it isn't. It's like, it is, but, you know, that kind of thing.
No, absolutely. And so I'm just trying to gauge your answer then. If I had to characterize the two camps, then would it be fair to say that you're sort of in the middle between Roddenberry and Meyer?
I would think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I believe it is. I mean, they dispense with what I considered all the the dumb right. stuff in the military, you know, dog and pony crap and all the stuff that doesn't really do anything to make you a more effective organization. They dispense with a lot of that day-to-day stupidity that I do not miss. But as far as the training and the responsibilities and, you know, the expectations, I think, and the sense of honor and the sense of duty and the sense of obligation, I think that is still very much in play.
So one of the things that I, one of the other successes I thought I gleaned from the book, or the thing that I enjoyed the most, was the camaraderie between Lorca and his crew that was on Tarsus as they were both, you know, the security force, at least initially, observing things, and then, you know, kind of the guerrilla tactics that they used, and just kind of the banter between themselves and the amount of, like I said, the amount of camaraderie that they had amongst each other. Where did that come from? Did that come from, you know, mirroring life of, you know, from your time in the Corps, or was it, you know, just a mixture of like your love of 24, or was it kind of a marriage of all of those things?
Yes, it was sort of a little bit of everything. Again, working with a largely clean slate so far as Lorca's background was concerned, I decided to have a little fun with him. So I made him a little Jack Bauerish, and I made him a little, you know, wise ass, and even a little bit of menace, you know, when he's in the interrogation scene with the one guy. Right. And I wrote it that way because I was also trying to show how the events were affecting Lorca and Giorgio on a personal level, but in different ways.
Right.
So in the beginning, Lorca is, I want to find this guy and make him pay, and I don't care how it happens. And Giorgio, of course, is the first responder, and she's the rule of law and the obligation and the duty and all of that, and Starfleet standards and all that kind of thing. And then they meet, and they're not really at odds, but they're obviously coming at it from different perspectives. And then as the story unfolds, you start to see it commingle and even blend back on each other. Like now Giorgio's like, well, let's just get this prick. Not quite to that degree as Lorca, but right. she's sort of loosening that whole, you know what, yeah, we're going to do what we need to do to stop this guy. And Lorca is forcing himself to remember that he has a higher call or higher obligation to answer to. But he's still pissed off, and that's going right. to drive. So there's a little Jack Bauer in there, particularly toward the latter half of the book when they're hunting him down.
Right. Yes. Yes. Very much so.
See, I misapplied that. To me, that was like a Batman kind of attitude to
yes,
it. But maybe
do.
Batman and Jack Bauer yes, have more similarities yes, than I may have thought.
That could be. It's possible. That's possible. Yeah. I'm a huge Jack Bauer fan. I love that show. There's a scene, particularly in the first series, the first season, where he is at the end of the night, and he's going after the guys at the dock or whatever in the marina. And he's got a pistol in each hand, and he's just shooting the crap out of everything. I hope you don't have a parental advisory because I just blew it.
I don't know what your
rating is, but I can totally test that boundary. But he's just shooting the crap out of everybody and everything, and he just doesn't care because he's running from now. He's angry because he thinks his wife's and his daughter or his daughter's been killed. So he is totally off the chain at this point, and that's what I wanted a little bit of that with Lorca toward the end, where he's got a phaser in each hand and he's just going to town. I want a little bit of that.
That's really cool. Is there a kind of Star Trek story, whether it's in one of the film mediums or in a book, that has not been told that you think should be told, whether by you or by somebody else? Like something that you think maybe Star Trek needs? Like there hasn't been a significant amount of focus on like the soldiers on the ground, like Rachel's rewatching DS9 right now, and she just rewatched the siege of AR-558. And it doesn't seem like there are enough of those. Like we could have used an episode like that from Discovery, I think. But are there any other kinds of stories within the Star Trek franchise that you would like to see at some point?
You haven't had a musical yet.
It's true.
First of all, I love that episode, Siege of AR-558, and other shows like Nor the Battle to the Strong, where you see that kind of ground pounder, you know, in the dirt type story. Set it away from Star Trek, that's the way I like to look at my military science fiction or military fiction, is I love to go down to the rank and file, the people that are on the front, you know, the front line or in the trenches, so to speak. Those are where I think the more interesting stories are, because they're the ones who don't necessarily have the big picture. They don't have the full picture. All they have is what's in their line of sight and what's to their left and their right. That's all they know in terms of a larger war or conflict going on. Those to me are more interesting stories. But the problem with that is I don't know how you do that on a consistent basis as a Star Trek story, because we're not supposed to be all about war and stuff. But I think DS9 did it right when they did Siege of AR-558. I mean, it's a little disturbing in a couple of places when you see what these people are reduced to. I'd love to take a crack at a story like that. I just don't know where I would set it. But of course, Discovery opens up a new area where I may not have thought to place a story like that. As far as what I would like to do, I don't know if there's a particular type. The thing I love about Star Trek is you can tell just about any kind of story in this framework, and it can work. When people ask me, if I'm introducing my boyfriend or my girlfriend or my partner to Star Trek, what are some episodes? And I can give them a list that's all kinds of different types of stories, action adventure and morality play and humorous and even silly, depending on how you want to go. I don't know if there's any one kind of Star Trek story that has not been told. At least I'm having trouble coming up with one.
Romantic comedy?
Romantic comedy. Manhunt was a romantic comedy. Anything with Luxana Troi and Picard, I guess, could qualify.
Yes.
Luxana Troi and anybody
really.
Odo.
Aside from musical, sure. No, offhand. Now, as far as what I would like to do, personally, do I have one in my pocket that I'd love to do if I was given a chance? I have always wanted a Star Trek version of The Right Stuff. So basically, what makes us decide to go out and push past and look at Mars and Saturn and Jupiter, and what is it that drives us out there? So we're talking, 50, 100 years before Enterprise. What in that period between First Contact and Enterprise, what made us do this? Or even before First Contact, it's like, why did we go to Mars? Why did we go to Saturn? Why did we do that? Because in the framework of the show, we know that there was a Saturn mission in the early 21st century, and there was a Mars mission in the early 21st century, but we don't know why they went. And looking at today's reality, it's like there's no real rush to get out there. Nobody's chomping at the bit to go out to Mars. And the reason we went to the moon was largely a political exercise. We wanted to beat the Russians. So in my brain, what is it that's got everybody ramped up and amped up enough to drive all the way out to Saturn, in short, or points farther? What makes us go out there? What is it that, and then so what does that do in terms of kickstarting our space program for the 21st century? And then, and then First Contact comes along, and then we start doing what we're doing. And then there's 100 years between, First Contact and Enterprise. So what happened in that 100 years,
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because the most recent episode, because Star Trek is always on in the background in our apartment. That's just the way that it is. But the most recent episode of Enterprise that I watched was First Flight, which kind of went. See, not really.
If my one, and it's not really a complaint, it's just I would have done it differently if it was me. That whole first season would have been like First Flight. The building of of getting to the point where the NX-01 launches, so The Right Stuff, or From the Earth to the Moon, the miniseries from God 20 years ago on HBO. So I'm a huge fan of the Apollo, Mercury, Gemini space program era. So I would love to do a Star Trek version of that. So if they ever give me the keys to that kingdom, watch out.
We'll start banging the drum on your behalf.
There you go.
I mean, we get maybe 150 listeners or so. So, I mean, it's not going to be a loud bang.
Don't get me wrong. Pocketbooks has been very tolerant of my antics over the years, and they've indulged me on a number of occasions when I come up with a crazy story idea. I don't know. I wrote a book a few years ago where I was able to blend aspects of Star Trek history and 20th century Earth history and the UFO paranoia craze and the Cold War and the space race, and I just blended it all together. And that was largely an exercise in self-indulgence, and they tolerated that and then even let me write a couple of follow-ups to it. So
interesting. What is that called?
The first one is called From History's Shadow. It came out about 5 years ago now. So
Good to know.
She's logging it in her brain right now.
I had a lot of fun with that one. So it was, you know, they let me basically go run wild and do that. And I came back and behaved and wrote a proper next gen book or something.
we're getting near the end of our time, but one of the things I wanted to ask you, which is just I love doing, you know, the pedantic continuity stuff on our show, because that's just where I thrive, I guess. I'm that kind of retentive fanboy. But I know that Greg Cox wrote a series of novels that dealt more specifically with Khan and his rise on Earth. Now, since we're about 20 years removed from the 90s, how is that something that squares? Is that still pretty much a part of Star Trek 20th century history? Or if you had to address it in a future work, how would you go about doing that?
Oh, I love those books. They're two of my favorites. And in fact, the History Shadow book that I mentioned, I go to great lengths to make sure that it's in step with those books.
Really?
Yeah, I'm a huge nerd for that thing. And not only that, but Greg also wrote a standalone novel a few years back called The Rings of Time, which talks about the first mission to Saturn. And so I made sure to be consistent with that as best I could with my books. I wanted it all to work together. So yeah, we're 20 years removed from when all that supposedly happened. And the way Greg sets it up, if you're trying to blend Star Trek history and real history and not make it an alternative, you know, a truly alternative history of Earth, then that was probably the best way to go. Not everybody thought it was a great idea. They wanted it to be the way the show portrayed it, you know, back in the 60s, looking forward to the 90s. And, you know, then reality came along and overrode it. But I'm like, nah, to me, it's more fun to try to blend them together still as much as you can. You're not going to win every fight. You're going to have to see some of that just a reality, but you know, not without a fight.
There you go.
Well, nice. And there's one thing that I want to bring up, and then I know that Cicero has a question for you, but Kirk is my captain. The original series is my favorite show in the Star Trek canon. Those are the characters that I fall in love with. I mean, I think of them as fond best friends on an alarmingly regular basis in my daily life. So the chapter that you wrote that included a young James Kirk was one of the highlights of 2018 for me. when you wrote that, first of all, how do you, because obviously Kirk is a character that you personally know very, very well, being an enormous fan of the original series. One specific thing that I wanted to ask you about it, did you try to throw a little bit of a reference into Kirk Fu in there when you had these security guys that were twice his size having trouble holding on to him? And just if you could expound a little bit on your philosophy on writing that chapter, I would love it.
Well, I am a diehard original series fan. It is the one I grew up with. It is my favorite. It is there. I mean, it's not even a race. It is the original series. And then I look at everything else, you know. That's not a ding against the other shows, but it's just that it starts with the original series with me. Whenever I write a Star Trek story and it touches on any aspect of original theory series mythology, I'm very conscious of how that is done, and I'm very protective about the original show. Not to the detriment of the other show, of course, but just, you know, hey, it's the holy grail for me. So when we were writing the Vanguard series, or we were writing some of the other things that spin out from the TOS timeframe, you know, we're always very protective of all the shows, don't get me wrong, but those of us who worked on Vanguard are very protective of the original show. So we weave in and out of continuity and we hug it as tightly as you can and not disrespect it if at all possible. When I wrote the chapter with Kirk, we talked about it. We almost didn't do it. I was reluctant to do it because I didn't want to delve too far into fan service. But at the same time, how can you have a story on Tarsus IV and not have him there?
Sure.
So we had written down a list of potential cameos, at least I did on my whiteboard in my home office, and Kirk was at the top of the list. And then is she or is she not there aspect with Hoshi Sato? Was Hoshi Sato at Tarsus IV? And I swear I watched that stupid episode on that Blu-ray 5 times. I freeze framed it and went through that scene step by step to make sure. And that part of her bio is never visible on screen. And then I confirmed with statements that Mike Sussman had made about it, where he said, you know, he wrote all this stuff, but they didn't use it. And there's disagreement and debate about whether it was on the show. And I'm like, dude, I got the screen caps. It was not there. So once I had that going for me, I was like, okay, if I use Kirk, then I don't need to use any of these other cameos. So it has to be Kirk. And then as far as writing him, yeah, I wanted to give a little nod to the future. So yeah, the whole bit where he's able to kind of slip away from the security guard and surprise Giorgio while doing it, that's a little nod to Kirk's rather singular fighting style.
awesome.
And as far as his ability to see a problem and maybe see an aspect of a problem, that others don't see, which, you see that all the time on the show because he's the hero. But I wanted to have a little bit of fun with that, where she kind of looks at him and went, this kid's a pain in my ass right now, but with the proper guidance, he might turn out to be something. He's a punk with potential.
Right.
So that's kind of where I left that. And one scene's enough. I thought if I could just do this one thing with him, then I don't need to touch on it anymore. So that's where I went with it.
Well, and Robert Petkoff did such a beautiful job doing a Shatner mime. I mean, my God, it was just perfection all around.
Well, Robert Petkoff is a self-admitted Star Trek fan. He loves doing these audios, and I've been fortunate that he's been the reader for all of the ones he's done mm-hmm. for me. All the ones that have been done for me, he's been the reader. Wonderful. So. I benefit from his enthusiasm.
Awesome. As do we all.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, so Dayton, is the final question. Final question is always the toughest. Set your phasers to concentration. Let's get ready. So we know that your favorite series is TOS. What is your favorite movie?
Ooh, that's a good question, because that changes. for the longest time, it was Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II. I have a soft spot for. I don't hate anything. Let me just say I don't hate any of the films. I just am disappointed to certain degrees by certain films, but I'll watch them all. Star Trek II was probably my favorite for the longest time, but I've kind of softened my stance on the first one, motion picture. I watched it when it first came out. I was 12 years old when it came in theater, and I was bored out of my skull when I watched it. And only as I got older and watched it as an older person did I start to appreciate what it tried to do. Kind of like 2001. I watched 2001 when I was a kid, and I completely did not know what I was watching. I was an idiot. But as you get older, you're like, oh, okay, I get it now. I understand what he's trying to do. Star Trek II is probably my – if I had to recommend a single Star Trek film to a new person who was coming to Star Trek, it would be Star Trek II. And they'd be like, well, what about Star Trek I? And like, don't just ignore that one.
Right, right.
But in terms of – don't forget the number 2 in the title. Just go with it. You're fine. That's probably the best. And then if you're looking for my wife used to recommend Star Trek IV to people, and I'm like, it's a fun movie. It's a romp, and I laughed at all the appropriate places, but I don't know that it's the best Star Trek story. Right.
Well, that's I was pretty sure that you were going to go with 2 because and Star Trek 1. I mean, especially if you're going to be talking to a neophyte in the franchise, that's something that you work up appreciation for.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's not the one that I would give somebody cold and go, here, watch this, you're going to love Star Trek.
Probably not. But the most embedded – in fact, I don't know if you're familiar with the Trekspertise YouTube channel, but the guy who does those wonderful video essays, most of them have to do with Star Trek. A lot of them are just general science fiction. But he came on this show a couple of times, and his favorite movie in the franchise is the motion picture. And I think he comes from that sort of very old school appreciation of what constitutes science fiction.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I appreciate what it tried to do. Odds on, just point blank, it reached higher and farther than any of the Star Trek films since, in terms of what it tried to do.
Sure.
So for that alone, I got to give it points. It really was ambitious. They didn't hit all the marks, but I got to applaud them for the effort, because they really were trying to be a Star Trek version of 2001 to more or less. So for that, I give it kudos. But I enjoy it more as an adult than I did as a kid. And when the director's edition came out, I liked it even more than I had before. I guess I'm just one of the weird guys. I don't know.
No, that's I'm still wishing that they'll remaster the effects and actually master them in HD so that they can release it on Blu-ray at some point. But
I would love to see them do that for like the 40th anniversary or something, which is next year. Yeah, for those of us who don't feel old already, boom. No, I would love to. I would love to see that. When people ask me about the effects for the original show, the ones that were redone for the 40th anniversary. I have the Blu-rays, I have both versions, and to be honest, certain episodes I like watching the new RiffX, but by and large, when I play it just to play it, I'll just default to the original effects. What I'm familiar with. It's a comfort food, you know?
Right.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was interesting that CBS All Access streams only the original effects, whereas Netflix does not.
I think that has more to do with the distribution and syndication deals that were in place prior to CBS All Access coming online. I think eventually those agreements will expire and you will get the remastered effects to the streaming service.
Interesting.
That's my understanding. Don't know if that's true. That's my guess based on what I've read.
Sure.
Nobody's come out and said that, but I'm like, that's the only thing that makes any sense, because why go to all the trouble if you're not gonna run it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
It's the same thing with Next Generation, the remastered Next Generation, which, you know, I don't know if you've ever actually compared them side by side, but that show never looked that good when it was aired originally.
Right.
I remember when they announced the project and then they came out with a little sampler Blu-ray with like four or five episodes on it, and I went and bought it at Walmart for $10 or whatever it was, and I came home and threw it in there and I'm like, oh my god, you know, I watched
it looks as good as I remember.
It looks better than I remember, because I remember watching it thinking everything's all washed out and blurry and crappy and faded, and I could not believe the color and the detail in those sets and uniforms that you never saw when it was on TV, because they, you know, they filmed it and then they composited the whole thing on videotape. I couldn't believe how much was lost in that transfer.
Right.
I was blown away by that.
It was phenomenal. And I hope that DS9 gets a similar treatment. I'm not holding my breath, but it's definitely it's probably at the top of my Star Trek wish list overall.
My understanding is that they lost money on the next gen project and they didn't make nearly enough money to justify doing DS9, which they perceive as not being the revenue generator that Next Gen is.
Right.
Which is a shame, because I think it would look gorgeous in HD.
Yeah.
And Enterprise was already shot in HD, so that was an easy fix. They just rolled that right out. But I would love totally to see all of the shows. I mean, even Voyager, get it remastered so that it can be run on streaming forever.
Yeah. Yeah, future-proof it for generations to come, probably. But, all right, well, Mr. Ward, we've gone a little bit over time and can't thank you enough for joining us. Where can people find you, and what should people be looking out from you in the weeks, months, maybe years ahead?
You can find me on the intrawebs at DaytonWard.com. That is my launch pad for my blog and my social media platform. You know, everybody's got to have a platform now. So Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all that other garbage that they say is important when you're an author. I call it my portal to internet banality. Anything banal and Dayton related, you can find it there. The next thing that I've got coming out is I did a couple of books for one of my, a couple years ago, I did a couple of travel guides, Star Trek themed travel guides for a company called Inside Editions. And they have another imprint called Incredibuilds, where they have partnered with the different licensees to create these little wooden models that you can build without glue or tape or any kind of other adhesive. And then they package it with a book of information about the topic that, you know, the model, the subject of the model. So they've done the first two Star Trek ones. I got to write the books that go with the TOS Enterprise and the Next Generation Enterprise. And the model book set comes out next month. One for each of those. And we're talking about future ships in that series.
Nice.
Great. Excellent. Oh, that's good to know. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope you had a good time too. And we'll be keeping an eye, and hopefully we can talk again soon sometime.
Yeah, I look forward to it. Thanks very much for having me.
And with that's going to do it for this episode of Discovery Debrief. Again, a very special thanks to Mr. Dayton Ward for joining us for our latest episode, and be sure to check out all of the greatness that has his name on it, as well as to keep an eye out on our show's social media feeds to find out when we'll be returning to duty for you. If you'd be so kind, we'd also appreciate it if you wrote a review for the show on iTunes or Facebook. It only takes a minute, and we'll be happy to read your review on the air when it's posted. If you have any questions, you can follow the show on Twitter at DSCDebrief, where you can also find all of our individual Twitter handles, and feel free to send us questions through Twitter our Facebook like page, or by emailing us at hailingfrequencies@discoverydebrief.com. Be sure to keep your eyes on our channels for future plans, and hopefully we'll have more surprises for you coming up very soon, especially if you're a longtime fan of the Star Trek franchise. As always, though, until we meet again, please go boldly, my friends.